The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning, how are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. Well done to everyone that was involved in the parades yesterday. I hope you had a fantastic day. It's lovely to have a St. Patrick's Day on a Friday and leading into the weekend. So those visiting us as well, you're very welcome to the county and I hope you'll enjoy your stay and you are enjoying your stay here. Now, we've a very, 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 very busy programme, so I better get to it. Later on, we're going to be talking about the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally and they have the prestigious honour of hosting the All-Ireland National Vintage Rally and that'll be taking place on the East weekend. So I'll tell you more about that. We'll be talking to the people involved. We'll be talking to our president, Johnny Egan, who would you believe is in his 99th year. And he talks about, I suppose, the evolution of machinery down through the years. So well worth staying tuned for that. And we'll have our Speaking of Poetry with Bernadette Nerida as well. Now, but first, to lead us off, the students on the Digital Journalism, Radio Broadcasting and Podcasting course offered by Radio Kerry and Kerry College, under the guidance of Connie Broderick and I, have created a documentary on tattoos. With a shared passion for storytelling, editing and production, they've used their skills to examine the world of tattoos and how they have evolved into a global phenomenon. The documentary explores the history of tattoos and their cultural significance, as well as their artistic connotations and the multitude of reasons why people get tattoos. And just a little health warning, listener discretion is advised as we will be dealing with serious issues in this documentary. So have a listen to this.
On the surface of your canvas, on your body, there's a story. Through the pain and the ritual, tales of sadness and of glory, until we found who we are and marked it in our skin. We can't express.
I suppose I originally associated them with sailors and people from that sort of background, and I know it's different these days, but I still don't like them. I think they're unnecessary. I think the human skin is lovely as it is. It doesn't need adornments.
I personally love them. People express how they want their body to look.
Not a fan of them, to be honest. I'm more of a religious person, so I believe that God created the way he wanted us and we are perfect as we are.
I think tattoos are a way of kind of expressing your, like, your interests and your ideas and their way of telling stories about your life, just eye on your body.
Tattoos are an ancient art form, used by people to express themselves and their cultures for centuries. From the traditional tattoos of the Polynesians to the intricate designs of Japanese Irezumi, tattoos have evolved into a global phenomenon. In Ireland, 35% of all adults have a tattoo, and the average number of tattoos that people get are 2.
Tattooing is an old art form, and basically when you get a tattoo, we're doing a ritual, you know. It's blood, it's energy, it's ink.
Andreas Gomez is the owner of Ancient Rituals Tattoo, a custom tattoo and piercing studio in Killarney.
It's an ancient art form, you know. This is from the Neolithic times. So you have mummies that they have a lot of designs covering tattoos, you know. Incredible to see. Circles and lines, you know. You can see the tattoos perfectly in the body, you know. So, yeah, the history is... People love to go together and to mark your body, you know. You have the different tribes in all over the planet making tattoos, you know. You have the Polynesia, yeah, they used to do all animal related designs, you know, in black. They didn't have needles, but they used sharp spike thorns, you know, or pieces of wood, you know, really sharp, and then they were hocking the skin, you know, and creating patterns and designs. And then you have Japan as well. They used to use wood blocks prints, you know. They used to carve wood blocks, you know, make prints and have these amazing paintings and designs, and then the tattoo artists start using that as a reference and making the designs into tattoos, you know, and then covering the whole body, you know. Yeah, so it's many of styles, you know. But for me, after many years creating and doing tattoos, now it's all about the experience, you know. It's about me marking people and doing a design that is going to be for you. So it could be a story, you know, or it can be just because you like to get tattoos, you know.
There are many reasons why people decide to get their first tattoo. For Simeon Sherwood, it's a uniquely personal one.
Yeah, so I've always wanted a tattoo, but I decided that a good reason would be to commemorate my family and my ancestors, because I never met my father, but he was sent over to England by my grandparents to escape slavery in Jamaica. I'm going to get the Sherwood Forest Tree, which is where my last name comes from, because they didn't have a name because they were slaves, so they took the name of the area they moved to in England, which was Sherwood Forest. And so I'm going to get the Sherwood Forest Tree with a broken chain around it to commemorate my ancestors' escape from slavery. So I'm going to get the tree done as a sort of tree of life, like to commemorate the my father's passing, you know, life and death as is above so below. But I went to the tree because the major oak is a very, very old tree. People don't think that slavery is something that happens these days. They think, oh, slavery was abolished, you know, 300, 400 years ago. But it was just made illegal. It still happens in some places. And it's just a way of sort of remembering that, you know, my grandparents managed to stop that in our family.
As mentioned by Andreas, Europe's oldest mummy, believed to be over 5,000 years old, had tattoos. He had 61 tattoos, all in groups of thin black lines, and suffered from medical conditions that matched a part of his body where his skin was tattooed. It's been speculated that the tattoos were used for joint relief as a form of ancient acupuncture. Today's tattoos can be used for aesthetic reasons while also having a medical purpose.
Basically, I am covering the scar tissue with a decorative tattoo. Or sometimes women want a restorative tattoo, which means during the surgeries, they've lost their nipple. And I can recreate a 3D realistic nipple using tattoo techniques and tattoo ink.
Aisling Mahon is a tattoo artist from Kildare who specialises in mastectomy restorative tattooing.
Well, firstly, I started scar cover-ups actually quite early in the career, and it was mainly like self-harm. I seen it a lot in the community coming into the studio space, and over time I became known for my scar cover-ups. A lady came in with a mastectomy scar and she didn't want to go the nipple route. She just wanted flowers. And I said, perfect, that's what I love to do. So we collaborated on that piece. And then I was like, oh, I need to train in this. This needs specialized care. You know, you're dealing with skin that's gone through radiation. It doesn't hold hydration. The cells are completely different. So I knew I just needed certain guidance on it. And I wanted to respect it as well. You know, that what I see is quite life-changing. And I don't say that lightly. I say that from a space of I meet my clients minimum twice. So I get to see them for the first session. And then after 10 weeks, they come back in. And that's the day when there's laughter and like joy. There can be tears of release. You know, it's a release of everything they've done. It's a final stopper. They're looking in the mirror and they're going, oh my God, I didn't think I could be back to this again. You know, I feel like complete. And then when they come back at the 10-week follow-up, they're like, oh my God, you'll never guess what. And I'm able to do this. Or like some women after 10 years have started dating again and they're like, I found a boyfriend, you know, all this lovely stuff. And I'm like, yes, you know, or they're excited with their husband again and just lovely, lovely, really intimate things. And one lady said, it's just instead of looking at the mirror and going and tensing up, she goes, ah. And it's just that subtle change that's changed their life.
Saoirse Kelly from Kerry struggled with self-harm for 6 years and decided to get a tattoo to cover the scars.
So I suffered from mental health issues, and as a result, from ages 13 to 18, I began self-harming. And because of that, I have over 180 scars on my body. Tattooing was something I always liked. Everyone around me had tattoos and I've always appreciated them and I've always wanted them. But for years, I was kind of afraid that my struggle with getting clean and the actual scars themselves would kind of prevent me from getting a tattoo. In January 2021, I decided to get a tattoo because I had managed to convince myself to get fully clean. And when I was researching self-harm cover-ups and things like that, I noticed that the sensation of it tends to be really, really similar, nearly identical to the form of self-harm that I was doing. So I let myself wait a while. I ended up waiting 2 years. And that's when I decided and got my tattoo done and picked out my artist. I got a death moth, which is a moth with the pattern of a human skull on his body. And in the foreground, there's some mushrooms. And then up by, like, the inside of my elbow, there'd be, like, a crescent moon. So it was kind of like a new life, new beginning type of a thing, but with a more grungy feel to it, because that's the art style that I prefer. Now, most people, when they're asking me about my arms, it's more about the tattoo itself than it would be the, like, actual scars, because you can't see them. So the whole process really boosted my confidence.
Yeah, we'll return to that documentary on tattoos after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Now let's return to the documentary on tattoos that the students on the Digital Journalism, Radio Broadcasting and Podcasting course have produced. And just a little health warning, listener discretion is advised as we will be dealing with serious issues in this documentary.
My name is Lorena Pesquequera. I'm a scalp micropigmentation technician. So what I do is that I provide a tattoo which it conceal the hair loss or cover the baldness. So basically, is it a tattoo that replicates tiny follicle? It can be used for different kneading. So either we can use it for camouflage some scars on the head from hair transplant or injuries. It can be used if you have thinning hair, so you can place these tiny dots in between the hair and it gives the impression of thicker hair. Basically, it replicates a shaved look. When you do the tattoo, is there so you have a result that is visible straight away. The more the people they see the result, how good are the result? And the more people are learning that this it's a very valid solution for cover the hair loss. They feel more confident, they smile, they tell me why I didn't do it before. I had a guy, my client, he's very, very young. You know, this can look like a little thing. But when I did the scalp pigmentation, he was like, finally, I can go to the restaurant with my girlfriend that I don't have to wear the hat. I feel great without it. I couldn't believe I waited for so long. I was so concerned. And now that I did it, it's life-changing.
Originally from Santiago, Chile, Andreas Gomez is influenced by tattoo styles from all over the world.
It is an art, you know, and you have different styles, so you can do all of them or you can just do one of them. So it's many of styles, you know, starting with Japanese, with traditional American, Polynesian designs, tribal designs, and then now you have like the black work or mandalas and dot work, neo-traditionals and new school. You can do different type of fonts, you know, and that they look really good. You have the black and gray traditional, you know, the Chicano style from Mexico. Some people, for example, they like the shape of the kanjis, you know, the Japanese symbols, yeah? So, yeah, you can put whatever meaning you think. So, in Ireland, for example, Ireland has a lot of symbols, yeah? All the Celtic designs, all the shamrocks, you know, harp, all the organ writing, yeah. So Ireland is one of the countries that has more designs for tattoos than any other country. So it's really nice to do tattoos in Ireland, you know.
So
So something I have noticed learning how to tattoo in Spain as compared to Ireland, the way that they approach colour tattooing is just phenomenal. Like, I've never seen anything like that. To be able to go into work and to see them in action creating these tattoos that look as if they're printed onto the skin, it's just amazing to watch.
Lauren Moore from Ballyhaig is a tattoo artist in the Spanish capital, Madrid.
My favourite type of tattoo to do, I think a colour tattoo. I've been doing black work since I started tattooing. Doing colour for me is such a new experience and it's really fun. Sometimes it can be a bit stressful for sure because there's so much to learn, but it's really, really rewarding to finish a colour tattoo and have it be really vibrant and beautiful. It's lovely to get a tattoo that is meaningful to you or sentimental, and it's such a beautiful thing. But it is also a beautiful thing just to get something you like, be it just a piece of art that makes you happy, something that you're going to look at every day and smile and laugh and think, oh yeah, you know, that's on my body, I'm happy.
Some people get tattoos to mark a significant time of their life. And that's no different for Johnny Quaid, who got his on the 10th anniversary of a workplace incident that left him paralysed from the waist down in 2006.
I suppose tattoos came maybe a year, 2 years after my accident. I was about, I think, 20 years of age at that stage, and got my first tattoo on my forearm, and it says, only God can judge me. I suppose I was going through kind of a time trying to find myself and the disability and who I was and who I will be from now on. So I suppose that quote was the reminder all the time of, you know, the different life I have now. And about 10 years later, the 10-year anniversary of my accident, I was on holidays and I decided to get the date of the accident underneath that quote. As well, so I have the 23rd of the 3rd 06 right under Only God Can Judge Me on my arm, and it's a reminder to this day about everything that I've gone through and what I've come through, and I'm strong enough for that now.
Radio in the Morning with Cooper Nuna. I am so excited to talk with you today. Coming up on the...
Getting a tattoo isn't always an uplifting experience. Like for Una O'Carroll, an iRadio presenter and proud Kerry woman who had to betray her beloved county with a tattoo.
God, that was a long time ago now. That was with one of my ex-radio husbands, Aidan Power. And I think it was 2016 and Kerry were in the All-Ireland. I think it was a semi-final with Dublin. And obviously, me being from Kerry and him being from Dublin, there is great rivalry. And we placed a bet that there was going to be this huge forfeit for whoever lost the match. And I think Kerry lost, I was a point or 2 points at the time. Anyway, so I didn't know what was going to happen. So I came in on the Monday and he introduced me to this lovely girl from Longford. And she was there with her partner and I didn't know what was happening. Anyway, I got a tattoo on my arm. It covered the entirety of my arm. And the tattoo was of Dermot Connolly, who at the time was one of Dublin's best players. So anyway, there was a tattoo of Dermot Connolly's face on my arm, and then they had like some lines as well saying, oh, Dermot Connolly, the king of my heart. Now, I didn't know what they were doing, but I looked down and I saw this, and the tattoo girl was like, okay, this is, you know, it's not a permanent tattoo, but it will last for 4 or 5 weeks. And I was like, what? I can't go around with Dermot Connolly's face on my arm. Oh my God, I'm going to be barred from the kingdom. My father will disown me. My husband will divorce me. Just get it off. So, yeah, but at least I went through with the bet and I paid my debt. I didn't chicken out of it. So, and also, I was wearing the Kerry jersey underneath the Dublin jersey at the time when he forced me to wear the Dublin jersey as well, so that the Dublin jersey wasn't touching my skin. Mortified. But you're looking with a bit of crack as well. Like, and there's nothing like a bit of Kerry Dub rivalry, you know.
We'll take a break and we'll return to that wonderful documentary after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Now let's return to the documentary on tattoos.
Katie Lynch from Listowel has spent over €2,000 on tattoos as a form of self-expression and sentimentality.
I have €2,250 worth of ink on me at the moment, and that wasn't including the work in progress. For me personally, it's a form of self-expression and a way to show off art, and I get tattoos for sentimental purposes, and recently enough I've just got them because I like them. But like, you know, you could be spending your money on drinking, drugs and other things, but tattoos are going to last you forever. I'm a healthcare assistant, a support worker for people with special needs. It never seems to come up as an issue in my line of work anyway. I have had a few comments passed, and you know, people instantly judging me for my tattoos. I had one incident where a woman told me that I would never get a proper job because I was working in a shop at the time. She told me that no one would ever love me and that they looked dirty and that I was wasting my money just because I had tattoos. I think that's kind of the worst I've experienced. It is a lot more socially acceptable to have tattoos nowadays, where you'd find it's a lot more unusual to not have any tattoos or any sort of body modifications.
People with tattoos often struggle to find employment. Roughly 20% of people with tattoos regret getting them. One of the most common reasons for tattoo removal is because people struggle to find work due to biases towards tattoos. In a 2016 study, tattoo job applicants were rated significantly less hireable than those non-tattoo job seekers. For Patrick O'Dowd, his tattoos have made it difficult for people to approach him and have worsened his employment opportunities.
I'm 30 years old and I have over 80 tattoos. Didn't do myself any favours with regards to how people perceive me, considering I have Freak Show written above my eyebrow and I have a spider tattooed under my left eye. But I wouldn't say it's overall negative. Obviously people take a look at you, and the kind of trashy way I've done my tattoos as well, it's very old school black colour, very kind of prison style tattoos, and that was to kind of keep people away as such, kind of drive people away from me, personify that kind of an image, but it does it too well at times. Like that, I still managed to get jobs where I've been managing restaurants and bars and things like that. But as to regard with like jobs outside of an industry that I've experienced in, definitely small mentality. When I was getting my first visible tattoo outside of the collar line, we'll say, and it wasn't until after my knuckles were tattooed that the guy doing it said, "They're nice job stoppers now." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, hand tattoos are known as job stoppers because you'll never get a job with them."
Oftentimes, tattoos are chosen for their aesthetic value, whether it's an intricate design or a beautiful image. Tattoos can be drawn in many different styles, from simple cartoons to realistic recreations of movie scenes. They are one of the earliest forms of art, dating back thousands of years, and have a rich cultural history across many ancient civilizations.
Because you have the freedom to do whatever you want, you know. You know, you can design something really simple, or you can make something really complex that is gonna look really nice on the body, you know. And with the tools that we have now, and the quality of ink and the quality of needles, you can achieve really, really good pieces. You can do some realistic tattoos, you know, and you can do 3D tattoos that they look like they're coming out of your body, you know, some mechanical pieces, you know. It's huge, you know, you can do whatever you like now, you know. And it's some incredible artists doing tattoos at the moment, you know. So we love to do tattoos, we love to make people happy, you know, as well. It's an ancient art form, you know.
I always liked art. I see a sheet of paper, draw on it. Always been like that. My books in school were destroyed in drawings. My copies were destroyed in drawings. And then when I saw a show of people putting art on themselves, I just wanted one. And then I got Ohana on my forearm. And after that, then it became a big addiction.
For some people, tattooing is an addiction, as is the case with Chris O'Neill. The Kerry native has spent 12 grand getting over 50 tattoos all over his body.
Oh, when I first started getting tattoos, it was literally like one every 3 weeks for about 6 months. After maybe 3 years of getting them, I was like, alright, that's it, I'm getting a full body suit. I have my legs, my arms, my neck, behind my ears, my feet, my hand. The best way to describe my tattoos would be colourful, weird and out there. I have cartoons, I have video games, I have graffiti, I have animals, I have script. I have a couple, alright, that have a meaning. I have the one on the back of my neck for when my mother passed away. I want to get every space I have covered. I'll go from the throat down. I won't touch my face. I promised my mother I wouldn't touch my face, so I won't touch my face. Oh, everywhere else is going to be covered. Everyone will be like, oh, but when you get old and wrinkly and stuff like that, I'm just going to be like, so? Everyone gets old and wrinkly. I'm just going to be colourful and wrinkly. I'm just going to have art on me. I'm basically a walking canvas that's yet to be covered.
My name's Kyle Sherwood. I am the co-founder of the company Save My Ink Forever that specializes in post-mortem tattoo preservation.
Save My Ink Forever was started in Ohio in 2016 by third-generation mortician Kyle Sherwood and his father, Mike, whose ancestors hail from County Mayo.
So we specialize in preserving tattoos and archivally framing them as memorial art keepsakes. And we get a bunch of different reactions. You know, everyone does it for their own personal reasons. And it's one of those things, you know, that I tell people that tattoos tell a story. So each one has its own unique story or persona, so to speak. But families that get this done are super happy about it. They feel like that person, you know, came home with them. So that's what it's about. You know, and especially with the caliber of some of these tattoos that are being done today. So, of course, obviously you have the meaningful aspect of the tattoos, but you look at the work that some of these tattoo artists are doing today, and they're modern day Rembrandts and Picassos of the tattoo industry. And we don't feel that they get the credit that they deserve because their artistry is ink and skin versus ink and parchment. And, you know, we have the saying, you wouldn't burn or bury a Picasso. So that's what we feel that some of these tattoo pieces are. So we're for the first time allowing some of these tattoo pieces to live beyond the grave, so to speak, and for this artistry to continue on past the grave, but also, you know, the memories of that individual. You know, anytime you see that tattoo, it's going to spark a certain memory that you had about your loved one. So we feel it's a great way to remember people.
Another way to immortalize the memory of a loved one is a sound wave tattoo. These sound wave designs are paired with a smartphone app that can read the tattoo on the skin and play back a recording of the voice of a loved one or the melody of your favorite song.
My most recent tattoo is actually a voice recording of my father, who passed away in 2016. So it's my way of kind of remembering him. I think it's a really new way of showing people's appreciation for certain art and art that is important to them. How people want to decorate their body the way they want to decorate their body, and I don't think it's up to anyone to judge how people feel about their body or what they want to do with their body.
Today, tattoos are a common form of self-expression, worn by people of all ages and backgrounds. Whatever your view on tattoos, there is no denying their enduring popularity and cultural significance.
Stories of life and death, self-realization and salvation. Whatever the reason, for pain, laughs or pleasure, give meaning to your art, because true art lasts forever.
Wow. Wonderful documentary created there by the students on the Digital Journalism Radio Broadcasting and Podcasting course offered by Radio Kerry and Kerry College under the guidance of Connie Broderick and I. And what a great bunch they are, and what a wonderful production they did there. They should be all very proud. Fascinating insight into the whole world of tattooing. Now, an event-filled weekend is how the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally is being described, as it's taking place from April 8th and 9th on the Easter weekend. And they have the unique honour of hosting the All-Ireland National Vintage Rally this time, so all the stops are being pulled out. There's loads of events taking place. It begins on the Saturday, April 8th, with a tractor run and a car run as well in the afternoon. But first, I went along and I met with the people involved.
George McCarthy, chairman of the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Day.
So tell us about the actual Vintage Day. When did it begin, or how was it formed? How did it come about?
The time it came about, Joe, was when Maurice died. Actually, the day Maurice was being buried, there was a bit of a do there in Casey Brown's after, and there was a chat, we were sitting down together there, just talking about the thing, you know. And we just started talking about that we do a Vintage Day in his memory, like.
Mm. And why? Tell us about Maurice. Tell us about the man himself. What was he like and what was he into?
Well, Maurice worked in Affert Quarry with myself. Maurice was a mechanic. A class mechanic, like. Superman, like. Mm. He could do anything, like. And he was a big, big vintage man, like.
Okay.
You know. He was following vintage big time, like.
Mm. So he would travel around, not even the county, he'd go beyond that to these vintage days.
Oh yeah, he'd travel to counties, all different counties, like, you know, outside Limerick, Cork and Clare and Fermanagh, like, to Clare and all that, like.
Yeah. And so you decided to do the day then, and when was that? What year was it again?
That was in Maurice died the 20th of April 2008. Maurice died, and that September.
Yeah,
we had a rally. We had.
And what was in that first rally? Can you remember?
Tractors.
Yeah.
Station rangers was his big thing, like. Okay. He used to love them, like. And tractors and cars. We had a big turnout, like.
Yeah.
For the first day, like, it was a lovely turnout. In fairness, now.
Mm.
We were delighted with this, you know. But that was held in the lands of Gerard McCarthy that time. He'd be next John there where the Maurice is down in Banner, like.
Mm.
But we held a rally then every year after that, like.
Mm. Every year since
mm. Well, the COVID, of course, knocked back things a small bit, but we're up to the stage anyway now at the moment, Joe, where we're granted the Vintage All-Ireland.
Yeah. That's a huge honour, it must be, like, because 2008, it's not that long ago either in the grand scheme of things, and to be awarded such a prestigious thing, it must be great for the locality as well.
Oh, it's a taste, of course, like, it's brilliant altogether, and we're delighted and we're honoured to be getting it, like, you know,
mm.
because it's a massive thing for us anyway, like.
Mm. What do you think Maurice would make of it?
Oh, he'd love it.
Yeah,
it would be his pride. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely. No, they would like. Yeah,
mm. It's kind of, I suppose, I know they're kind of all over this county, but people love to go to them, don't they? And not just people that are mad into machinery or whatever. The general Joe Soap loves going to them as well.
Oh, they do. Yeah, people love to go and just walk around and see what's there, like, you know, we've stationed. You have all different types of things, all stuff, like, you know.
Mm.
But we're going all out this time, now, Joe. We're going to have all as much as all stuff as we can, like, and maybe work and stuff as well, you know.
Mm. And is this something you kind of plan all year, or does it just happen, or what? And I suppose there's added pressure this year.
You'll be planning away, you know. You'll be planning away, like, you know. If you're not already, maybe a couple of weeks beforehand, maybe a couple of months beforehand, you'll be thinking, but look, we're picking away this every day now, like,
yeah.
You know.
Have you anything yourself that you bring to it?
I have a bit of stuff, all right.
Well, go on, give us a bit more.
Yeah, I have a tractor, and I have two tractors, actually. I have a Fairmall Cub and a Massey Ferguson. And my wife, Kathleen, then have a Maurice Minor.
Really?
Yeah. 1971 Maurice Minor as well.
I'd say that brings up a lot of nostalgia for people, the Maurice Minor.
Ah, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, you'd have Massey cars in the day, like. You'd have a pile of stuff in the day, you know, like, in this. Cars, yeah. And tractors, like.
Uh-huh.
You would.
And that's what it's about as well, nostalgia. People remembering their youth, maybe.
Oh, it is. It is definitely no doubt. Like, well, for a pile of, we'll say, elderly people, like, if they come on the day, like, it's nice for them to see all the old stuff there again, you know. It brings back memories, I suppose, you know, compared to the way we're working today, like.
Mm. And what's amazing as well, a lot of it will outlive us all.
Oh, it will. Oh, it will definitely, like. That'll be there when we'll be all gone. And it's a lot of the new stuff, like.
Yeah.
It will outlive it, like.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, like.
And would you have a mixture of ages, men and women, that kind of attend these things, or you take part?
Yeah. Oh, you would, yeah. You would have women that would be interested as well as men, like. You would, yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I'll come back to you at the end, but I'm going to go around the house here now and talk to a few more about this wonderful event. And so thanks for now for talking to me, and I'll join you again in a while.
Okay, thank you.
Anthony Lynch, I'm the secretary of the Morris Collins Vintage there.
Anthony, how did you get involved first day?
I worked in the quarry back in 92, and Morris would have been the mechanic in the quarry, and I have been acquaintances of the family for years before that. When I'd have been a small man in Benna, I'd have came across Morris, and I suppose it was out of my love of all things rusty that we kind of became friends. And what do you call it, I just, when Joseph asked to know would I be interested in falling in, I said I would. Yeah. So that was kind of how it came about.
What kind of a person was Morris?
Morris was a gentleman. So he was very, very good with his hands. A good mechanical head in him. And if you had a problem with anything mechanical, Morris was the go-to man.
Yeah.
So he was.
And that takes a lot of brain power, doesn't it? To figure he's a problem solver as well as anything else.
Well, he'd have good common sense, and he'd work his way through a problem until he'd come to a solution.
Yeah.
And if the part itself wasn't readily available, he had the knowledge that he could find the part off of something else that would do the same thing.
Yeah.
Do you know, it was.
And I suppose people form friendships over that, don't they? Because, you know, you're sharing information and you're talking about something. It's like a football match or something, you know, you're discussing how you fix something or where something came from.
Through a common interest, I suppose. Mm. You know, that's how friendships are formed. Do you know, like, if you don't know everything, if you ask some person that's in the same interest as yourself, do you know, you'll get information. Yeah. People love to share information and to try and help each other out.
Yeah.
Do you know?
And I've no doubt even what Morris would have collected or the information he would have handed on, it kind of lives on in that way.
Well, I suppose the longer we go on in life, the more of a library we gather.
Mm.
No more than the computer today, do you know, with its memory.
Yeah.
In the person's memory, like, it gets bigger and bigger as time goes on. And
yeah.
What you see as a child and kind of can influence you as you go along in years, you know.
So tell us about this big coup you've got now, the National Vintage Day. What should people expect?
We have plans this year. We're going to be butter making, milking cow. There'll be tractors, cars, there'll be kids' amusements, there'll be music and dancing. We'll have haymaking if the weather is suitable, stone crushing, timber cutting, steam engine trashing, and the timber will be sawn by steam engine as well.
All right.
Yeah. We'll have flower arranging, threshing, there'll be auto jumble, tractor balancing, and there'll be block making. Just
tractor balancing, but that's not holding one tractor on either hand, is it?
Yeah, you will. No. It is where you drive a tractor up in a platform, and you get it to balance.
Right.
Now, there is a bit of skill.
Like on a little seesaw kind of thing?
Yeah. It's like
or
a
big seesaw.
A big seesaw, yeah. There's a bit of skill. It is not easily done.
Yeah.
Do you know, but test the skill of the driver.
Yeah. So, I know it's a massive success in the last few years, and you get big crowds, but you must be expecting a huge crowd for this.
Well, we would love a huge crowd, but I suppose what determines the crowd is the weather on the day. Do you know, and hopefully God will shine down on us.
Mm. What's the difference between a national and just a normal one?
The national is that people come travel further afield.
Okay.
Then the normal, you're dealing with the locals, but the national is they travel from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And some people bring displays from further afield and Yes.
Yeah. It is great to have kind of a day for it, though, isn't it? Like, because, you know, people are maybe solitary, gathering this stuff away, but then they get to share that on the day.
To display the Easter Sunday now is our day, and it's our day in the vintage calendar. And it's marked, which makes it very handy for us that we know our day exactly. But the problem that it can create is the weather can be very, very fine, or it can be very inclement.
Yeah.
And we have to work around it.
Yeah. So just a reminder, where exactly is it taking place and what date again?
It'll be taken in the part in the lands of John Clifford, next door to Artford Quarry, on the 9th of April, Easter Sunday.
Excellent.
We'll have a tractor run the evening before, and maybe a car run. So.
Oh, very good. That'll create the excitement.
That'll be creating the excitement, getting things underway. Usually, that's what usually happens anyway.
Very good.
You
were the man that contacted me there earlier, and you said I have to speak to one certain individual. Who am I going to be talking to next, and why should I be talking to him?
You'll be talking to our president, Mr. Johnny Egan.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Johnny is a wealth of information in all things vintage.
Now we'll take a break, and after that we'll be meeting the president, Johnny Egan.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Now we're talking to people involved in the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally, the All-Ireland National Vintage Rally this year, which is taking place on the Easter weekend in Ardfert. So let's hear from their president, Johnny Egan, now who is in his 99th year.
Johnny Egan. I'm from Tubrid, Ardfert.
Very good.
I'm better known as John. Like to know.
Okay. So, will I call you Mr. President, John or Johnny?
No. I don't like them names at all. Like, but to the fact that they happen to be one of the oldest fellas, I suppose, in it.
And myself
and Morris, I don't know Morris since he was a child, my own age nearly. And when Morris started working here in the garage, in Keller's garage in Tralee, he was there himself this time.
Mm.
And he went on then, he went a little bit out on his own for a start, but he didn't last long. It wasn't right. He went to England.
Mm.
And for I don't know how many years was in England. When he came home then, the whole big thing started in, like you see. He started working the quarry. He started first in a bit of his own below in Reiner's yard, and then the quarry started, and I suppose Pascal was looking for a mechanic, and he got Morris, and it's the whole thing spread in between. I was going to the vintage years before that.
Yeah.
And Morris had only the stationary engines, and all parts of the country wasn't great for stationary engines. But once we went a small bit east towards Limerick and Cork, it was all stationary engines.
Mm. What's a stationary engine now for people that wouldn't be inclined to machinery?
We said the small engine now that drives a concrete mixer.
Yeah.
And the engine itself, like you say.
Yeah.
And milking machines and all them big things that were big engines. Morris took a mighty big stationary engine. It worked in the quarry. Carol had it in the quarry for a short time. It was a standby for the electricity.
Okay.
A mighty big one.
Like a generator, kind of substitute.
Yeah, it was
generator,
the biggest two or three generators, like, so a mighty big one.
Mm.
We carried it to Killarney 1 year, and we carried it down to Upton. It was Upton that time it became Inishannon after. There were all the big stationary engine men were all around it. It was a generator, driving a generator. The whole thing was bigger than the quarry lorries at the moment, like you say. And he had it inside in one of the quarry lorries. And it kept all the interest that day, like, as well as fellas that had an idea and had no idea were anxious to see it, like I say. And it finished up in a bit early creamery then after. the electricity wasn't the best at the time, and was put into every door in the creamery.
Yeah, that's a piece of history there.
We'll take a break for the news at 10 and we'll return to the group involved in the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally after that.
The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Welcome along to the second hour of the Saturday Supplement. As I mentioned, the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally, the All-Ireland National Vintage Rally, is taking place on the Easter weekend. And it's taking place in the field adjacent to the Ardfert Quarry. And it's starting on April 8th. And there's a lot of events going on the 9th, including butter making, cow milking by hand, tractors and cars, all types of engines, dog show, children's amusements, auto jumble, threshing, hay making, stone crushing and timber cutting by steam, tractor balancing, block making, quarry tour, flower arranging, and so much, much, much more. There's music and dancing with Eddie Lee as well, and Easter activities for children, free entry for children as well. All proceeds to Down Syndrome Kerry, the Kerry Cork Health Link Bus, and the Kerry Red Cross. Now, let's return to that interview I did with the group involved, and we'll continue here to find out more about John Egan, their president, who's in his 99th year.
And you travelled all over then, going to these vintage runs yourself in Morris?
Yes. I was asking Morris to go, to come with me, and he wasn't inclined to go, but anyway. This day, as morning I said at Mass, I says to Morris, night of Mass, do you remember the cob? The cob, what? The cob tractor. Why do we? He says, such and such a fella belonged to my head, one of them. And it went on, so landed up to me after Mass, and I had the Bowen side and new, the new house. It wasn't finished, but nearly finished. And I had it, I put it together, and I had no mag. That was my problem, I had no mag for it. And I asked Morris about a mag, and he said, I haven't one, but he says, I have an idea where we'll get one. Why, so I told him I had a cob tractor, but I had no tractor for it, no mag for it.
What's a mag?
The magneto that makes the spark instead of the battery.
Okay, I'm with
you. You have the battery, the coil, and it's a whole lot in one little thing. I have one of the Fordson tractor at home if you want to see it.
Can I borrow it?
But, anyway, Morris and you located the mag for me from Donegal, Sam Cowan, Donegal. Convoy Donegal, Sam Cowan. And it's around about 100, something along with £100 anyway. Reconditioned and perfect, I have it all the time. It's the tractor in itself, they're all stored away in the corner, it won't be out for years and years.
And will they be at the vintage day now, no? Would you bring something to the National Vintage Day?
I used to have the cobalt, which was light and handy for carrying, for transport.
Yeah.
But I carried all over up where your man was thrown into the slurry, carried it up there, and McNamara asked me to do a bit of ploughing that day in the cabbage garden of Ballyfin College.
And so your friendship grew from there, really.
Grew.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I'm leaving today. Well, I'm out in Tubbard. Do you know Tubbard School?
Yes.
Do you know Sinnott's, the what did they put on? There below the class, the Tubbard class, the school is closed and private, into private building now, like. And I'm only up the road. It was the first house up the road from the railway gates. So you know, the train went out and to Limerick, and I was the first house up from the railway gates. Now I'm the seventh house. And
were you born at home or in hospital or where?
Oh, at home. At home. Uh-huh. There was no hospital, I don't think. Very little hospitals that time. But it was at home anyway, I was born.
Did you have a farm at home? No.
No.
No, your father was the carpenter.
Carpenter, a cottage acre, they called them that time. You know, the county council cottages. And
yes.
There was two types. There was one with a kind of a loft up in it, and the other was the lower one with no loft, with a different shaped house, a nicer house, like you see. But we built two rooms and two sinks, like you see.
Okay. And how did your love of machinery come then? Was it seeing the train, or what was it? What do you think sparked that as a young lad?
The father bought a threshing machine in 1936.
He bought a
new threshing machine and tractor. And the threshing machine was bought into Phoenix by boat.
Really?
Really. And taken off. It was to be taken off at Phoenix. And when they put it on the railway inside at the pier and brought it out, they couldn't take it off outside.
Why so?
There's place to see no room, and it was so small, and they weren't able to put the wagon to take it off to push it off, and it had to be brought into Tralee.
All right.
And there was £8 extra charge for the, and pile of trouble went on for a couple of years looking for the £8 because it was supposed to be delivered.
Yeah.
This is the only story now that I had heard.
Yeah.
But all the rest of the stuff would be exact happening.
Yeah. Did he go out and hire then?
Out and hire then.
Where?
I went as far as Mount Brandon, Morrow Grand, Dowds and Morrow Grand and Mount Brandon. I thrashed for him one year, but that's all the year we went. I go no more.
Yeah.
But
you made your money in the year.
Made part of money, but the bother was I couldn't get it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And back then, that was like the Mehel. The neighbours would come around and help, would they?
Oh, yes.
And how would you trash? Tell someone how you would trash. What's the process in that?
Well, that tractor that I have there, that was the tractor that was driving the thrasher.
You have a photo, yeah.
And the thrasher was a Ransom 42-inch, number 46, 11-4 medium. Was the number of it. This tractor then was the second tractor we had. The first one, I happened to be with me, it was an iron wheels.
Okay. And so you're taking out the photo now to show us, yeah?
Yeah.
And who's that handsome devil there standing up in it?
That's a fellow by the name of, I know, it's some choir name for him. He was a choir fellow.
That's yourself,
that's
isn't it?
Yes. That's myself.
And what year was that?
That would be 1940.
Yeah, and what age were you then?
I'd be 17, I think.
So what does that make you now?
Yeah, I don't know. You wouldn't find it nowhere, I don't think.
But are you 90?
I'm 98. And gone into the second half.
Flipping hell. 98 and a bit with it.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes,
and you look like you go out trashing tomorrow. So this is the photo we're looking at now. You're standing up and what kind of a tractor is it again?
The Forson Model N.
Okay.
There was two types of Forson, the olden ones, and the Model N was the first. That was one of the first three rubber tyres that came into Kerry. Think of that now. One of the first three rubber tyres. I was the only mechanised agricultural contractor in Kerry at that time. You had horsemen, which was pulling the binders with two horses, and the man would plough on, he'd do a bit of extra ploughing, but I was full-time contracting. I ploughed it, I prepared it. I didn't set much of it because the setting was a trade in the seed, so you had to spread the seed a special way. And I cut it and thrashed it and drew it to the merchants.
Really? From start to finish,
Yeah. And I don't know, is there any other fella that can say that? I doubt it, because the iron wheels were a dead loss for moving. And
why were they getting stuck in the ground, or what was the story?
Well, you had grips, iron wheels with iron grips cocking up about the height of them, hitting off of the ground. But that one of the first three. The first one went the Ferris Ratu. The Ferris Ratu got one. Mac the Cuddies of the Reeks got the second, and we got the third. And our third was specially ordered. We had around this wheel, see, there was a big cast iron band outside the wheel, the rubber. And there was 11 grips on that band. And they came up, when you turned them upside down, they came up about 2 or 3 inches over the wheels for extra grips for the thing.
Yeah.
And I have the iron, the one, the first tractor we had it on it up to 36, up to 3 years, 36, 39. That was first attached in the second half of 1939. You would have to tax it for the full year and insurance if we bought it before the half year. And it was taxed for the second half of 1936.
So there was still tax and insurance then?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And tell us the process of trashing, what's involved. What are you trashing, first of all?
Corn, be oats, barley, or wheat. I trashed beet sticklings, the beet seed, trashed bird seed for your man behind him, Phoenix Kelly. Do you know Kelly? They call him the bear, the big, strong, rough man. And bird seed, he made more out with 7 bags of bird seed. He made more out of the 7 bags of bird seed than he did out of all his years trashing, growing bees.
Who would buy the bird seed?
That's just took it and sent it to the open to the I know a man that worked in it well.
Is this chickens and hens or
the bird seed? You know, for birds the birds' kids, the smart stuff, you see. But all the seeds that came out of the corn, there was a screen in the bottom of the machine, and you diverted it into there, and it took all the small seed out of the corn. Yeah.
So you were separating it?
Separating it, yes.
And then you'd have straw left over?
There was a straw. There was acres and acres, because there was no use for the straw, like you see. The cows were on you. The biggest farmer, that him would have about 16 cows. There was only about 5 or 6 of them in our Kerry would have that many cows that time. But there are hundreds of them now.
Yeah,
there's a man across the road from me. His father had was 5, and there is he is in 90 something at the moment.
Yeah.
And the father had only 5.
Your father strikes me as a very entrepreneurial man to think that far. He was very forward thinking, it sounds
like. He was.
What was his name?
John Senior. John Jack, more or less Jack. I was called John. The brother was called Peter.
Yeah, that's some wonderful history there given by Johnny Egan. We'll take a break a little more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Let's return to Johnny Egan, president of the Maurice Collins Memorial Vintage Rally, which is taking place on the Easter weekend.
Tell me now, when you go into a vintage day, what do you make off first? What grabs your eye usually?
You go pull up and you ask for it, where do they want to?
Yeah.
They usually would have places spread out at them. And the later on in the years, they used to have a place for hurling at the football with the children. And they wouldn't want to there, like you would have to. They had all the tractors in one place and the station range. Limerick and Cork was alive with station rangings. There was all milking machines and milk, the broken down contractors that had got rid of the thing, and the concrete mixer. There was an engine in every concrete mixer, and they were broken with the frost, and fellas, some fellas kept half of them. You made one out of two or three of them, maybe, like you see.
Yeah.
I have one outside, and it's made out of two.
And when you're going to the Vintage Day now, the National Vintage Day, what's your favourite thing when you're looking at it? Is it the tractors? Is it the stationary engines?
The tractor. The stationary engine was... I had four bypasses in
1985.
Jeepers. And it wasn't too sound at that time, and to be hawking with the stationary engine, the tractor was handiest. It would start the tractor like a battery, start it, a nice tidy thing, put up on the trailer and go away.
Yeah.
And
you know, a lot of people, they kind of miss the days of the horse and the plough and things like that, but they were tough days, weren't they? Do you think machinery changed Ireland for the better?
Altogether, like you say, no. Fitzmaurice had only done their own work. They had a big farm and it was all ploughing and harrowing. They were kept going, which is like you see. The Cuddies of the Reese, they had a stationary thrasher inside the house, and they used to do their own thrasher an hour today and an hour in a couple of days' time. We, in our side of the country, you started and finished, you could be 3 days in the one place thrashing.
And big excitement, I'd imagine, when you'd come.
The bucket of porter going around. I used to love it. I hated it.
Yeah.
And just hated the smell of it. Never drank it while I was in my life, I said. Didn't like it. And
you never drank?
No.
No. Is it because it was served in a bucket, I wonder, or what?
No, I just didn't like it. The smell of it, he hated it.
Yeah.
What I used to love was the porter. You don't know what... You never saw it or heard of it. The farmer tapping the barrel, his own barrel of porter.
No.
The small tierce that time, there was the quarter tierce and the half tierce, wasn't it? And they'd bring, if they had a day's thrashing, they'd bring the small barrel.
Yeah.
And if they had the 2 or 3 days thrashing, like behind us, Rahini, now all the back that road, there'd be 3 and 4 days thrashing. And that one around the country. But
people must have been fairly merry while they were working, so after a while, were they? Or in good form?
Oh, you're a Christ, no, you'd be sweat. That's just sweat that was coming out of with the work. Can you imagine a man with a pike, bringing a pike of corn in straw, he couldn't lift it and carry it over, and you were up in the leather there against the historic straw, and you'd have to stoop down, take the pike, and pike and straw up to the fellow above you.
Yeah. You wouldn't be long sweating the porter out then.
that was it. The biggest thrill I used to get, there was only certain men that could tap the barrel.
Yeah.
The ordinary fellow couldn't tap his heart to go around the field. But the tapping of the barrel, old Dothery, like me, you know, myself, Dothery, my age, no, I couldn't do it. I hit the thing, and they'd have the tap, and you usually didn't get the best tap from the public.
Yeah.
And you'd have to put round paper around it where it goes into the barrel. And the old man that made out, he knew everything. First time he mightn't have the right a hammer, it might be a wrench or something to drive in. And usually when he'd go to hit it, he'd miss it, half miss it, and maybe half drive it in. And the porter, I used love to see the porter going over around the place.
I'd say you were the only one. I don't think the rest of them were too happy.
I used to love it. I could dance with it. I hated it.
Yeah.
And
why did you hate it?
Don't know.
Yeah.
Didn't.
Did you hate what it did, or did you hate the taste or the smell of
the
it?
The taste and the smell. Yeah.
No, Joseph, I can see why he's president anyway. He has some memory and great memories as well. And that's what it's all about, bringing that history to life. You know, we look at machinery there, but if there isn't a story behind it, it doesn't mean as much.
No. Johnny has it all there.
Yeah.
Every bit of it in fairness to him. Down through the years, sure, he worked at it as well, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's done the corn and everything like that, like, and he's done the trash and... You have the whole history, like.
Yeah, but even to have Johnny there on your vintage days as well to give that knowledge is brilliant as well.
Oh, it is brilliant, sir. We're fantastic. We're delighted, like.
Yeah. This of course is in Morris's memory, but it's also in aid of charity as well, and that's why you do this as well. So who are the charities that are going to benefit from the National Vintage Day?
Yeah, Down Syndrome Kerry, the Kerry Cork Link Bus, and the Red Cross.
Very good. So will you be fundraising on the day then, is it?
We will.
Yeah.
We will. And we'll be selling tickets as well.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Number of weeks before the rally comes up.
Excellent.
We will be doing that.
Yeah. Well, I want you, thanks a million. It's been an absolute pleasure. A lot of work goes into this as well. You probably have to thank people.
I do. I have a pile of people to thank, but I couldn't mention all the names.
Don't go mentioning names now. You'll only get yourself into trouble.
No, I won't mention names at all, but the people are brilliant. Big support. And we'd like to thank everyone that helps us in any way.
Yeah.
The other thing is, we have to thank our man, John Clifford, that's given us his farm. He's given us as much land as we want, next door to the quarry there. We have to thank him. And we also have to thank John O'Carroll, which is a big supporter of ours as well, for giving us their premises as well, anytime we want it, any hour, they do anything for us. So we'd like to thank everybody that helps us.
Excellent.
So, Joe, that's all I have to say.
And I'd like to thank you for welcoming me here, and I wish you all the best of luck with it. It's fantastic. I know a lot of work goes into events like this behind the scene, and they add so much to a locality and to the culture of the place as well. So best luck. And Johnny wants to tell me something else here, so I better go away. But thanks a million for that.
John, thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah, and we want to wish him all the best. That's the Morris Collins Memorial Vintage Rally, hosted by the Aveta All-Ireland National Vintage Rally. And it's taking place Easter weekend, April 8th and 9th. So a fun-filled weekend, like I mentioned, lots of different activities. So make sure to go along and support that wonderful event. It sounds like it's going to be a cracker. Now, after the break, we're going to have our Speaking of Poetry with Bernadette Nearida.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Now, so it's the third Saturday of the month, so that can only mean one thing. It's time for Speaking of Poetry with Bernadette Nearida, where Bernadette brings her selected poet each month to us, and we find out a bit more about them. We hear some of their poems. Bernadette, how are you? I was only talking to you not too long ago, by the way, at your lodge. So tell people, how did it go? I had a fantastic time anyway.
Do you know, it was brilliant, Joe, and thank you very much. But I couldn't have hoped for a better day and a better event. Everything went off brilliantly, and I'm delighted with it, and everyone else was as well, and thanks to your good self as well. A great day, absolutely brilliant, brilliant. I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
Bits. I'm coming down to earth now.
Yeah, excellent. No, it was lovely, and your family were there, and friends, and people, loads of people around the area as well, and from the arts world. It was great to see them all there, and it was a lovely afternoon spent in the Shanachie, which is a great place in Estoyle there.
By
Cara Trant. Yeah, she does a great job there, so it was absolutely fantastic. So well done. And where is Beneath My Skin? That's the name of this wonderful collection of poetry. Where is it available?
Well, it's available in the Shanachie Writers in Wolfe's Bookshop, in the Crystal Kay's Bookshop in Killorglin, the first chapter in Manor, and it will be spreading further a bit, but I'll update you on that when it happens, but it is going to spread itself out a bit, so at the moment. But I'm thrilled with it. I'm delighted I did it, delighted that it's out there, and look, getting great feedback and everything else.
Yeah, so, it's great to have local bookshops like that as well. What's the one you mentioned in Clorgan? What's it called again?
Crystal Cave Bookshop.
Crystal Cave, yeah. It's a lovely bookshop, actually.
It is.
It's great to have them, and they're supporting local writers as well, which is brilliant. So, Bernadette, you always bring a kind of a whopper to us, like, you know, where we're going, how we're going to get this in a half an hour. But who have you brought to us?
I brought the one and only Maura McEntee.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, I was thinking Maura McEntee because I suppose we've just celebrated International Women's Day, trying to, because the last few we did were male, so trying to do a gender balance. And look, it's Stockton the Gaelic as well, so. And she's a brilliant A larger than life character, I would say.
Yeah.
As
very
well as
good.
Her portrait. And
So where did it all begin for her?
She was born in Dublin, Joe, and I suppose in 1922. And if I could just say now at that stage, 1922, she lived to be 99. So because we're speaking about poetry, I'm going to throw in there that poetry is not injurious to the health, because she wrote so much poetry. God bless her. She lived a fine, long life. She was born, as I said, 1922, which, of course, all that was going on in Ireland at the time, that huge conflict and everything else. And not only that, but into her own family. She was born into a family that was fiercely Republican. Her father was Sean McAtee. Her mother was a Margaret Brown from Tipperary. And like her, both of her parents were, they weren't just supporters, they were actively involved in the Republican movement. Her father fought in the GPO. So that was kind of what Maura was born into in her personal family. But Sean McEntee, his name is like, I mean, he was Minister for Health and Social Welfare in Taoiseach, I mean, in later times, but that was more his beginning anyway. And I suppose it's fair to say as well that she was born into a very academic type of family, very, you know, that kind of scholarly kind of academic type. And her mother, definitely, her mother was teaching Irish in a college. And also, I suppose, because her mother, this would be uncles of Maura McEntee's on her mother's side, they were they had prominent positions in the Catholic Church, so they would probably be seen as an influential family as well. I know she had one of her mother's brothers was, I think, a Cardinal, Michael Brown, and then she had two of her mother's brothers were Monsignors and that. But so that was kind of, that was Maura's beginnings, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And they were strong. Her mother was a very strong woman, and I think that's where Maura got her strength. And she was Maura herself was a formidable woman, and she admits that herself. She describes herself thus. But if you think about, like, there's something, it's kind of amusing in one way, but it's serious too. But Maura remembers, like, just to give you a kind of a snapshot of her parents, she remembers her father and mother having an awful row when the Bunrock na Héireann, I think that was in the late, was it 37, I think. But when Maura's father was imprisoned, like, because he had been in the Republican movement and all that, Maura's mother had to keep the show going, and she took on extra teaching duties, you know, to keep the family going, not least of all financially. So when she saw, I don't know, do you call it a clause or an article in the Bunrock na Héireann that for financial necessity, women wouldn't have to work outside the home, Maura's mother was outraged. And her father couldn't see the problem. So Maura says that her mother said she couldn't speak to her father for days. They had an awful row over it. So there was a strong pull on both sides there. Very strong people, very opinionated, and, like I say, fiercely nationalistic.
Yeah, and Bernadette, that's timely as well, because, you know, they're talking about amending the constitution, and where it mentions a woman and the place in the home and things like that, and they're actually talking about, you know, amending that. So it's amazing. You're bringing a few things to us here this morning.
Yes,
that
that's
are relevant.
True. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, it is actually, because it was mentioned in the news, I think, last week. But anyway, Maura as well, you know, there must be great good in Kerry as well, because Maura had a great connection with Kerry and the west of Kerry and Dunquin, you know, in the Cochrane area. But that's something like that. I should be mentioning as well, I mean, she did an awful lot for the Irish language poetry. And I think we were saying at a time back, Joe, about Evan Boland, that she wrote women's voices into. But I think Maura would have brought the Irish language, you know, because, and that again came from her time in the Kerry Gaeltacht back in Dunquin. But she had her uncle, Monsignor Padraig de Brún, I think. He moved there, and they were all very scholarly, and he was doing a lot of research and scholarly, as well as his priestly ministry. But Maura, very, very young, and her siblings, I think she had a brother and a sister, but I think they were brought down there probably as well to alleviate, you know, if the mother was working, and, you know, because, you know, he was there.
Yeah.
But she became immersed in that, what she called that authentic, you know, Kerry, you know, the language of the people and the people themselves. And I do know that throughout her whole life, she had, I think she called it, a long-lasting, not only respect, but love for all the people of that area. And in fact, I think one of her collections is called On Paróiste Mír Tuilte, which is the Miraculous Parish. And I think she was referring, now it's not about doing Quinn or anything, but I think that that title came from what she thought of the people there.
But yeah, she was saying, Bernadette, there's a great quote there that, you know, the luck that brought her to the Gaeltacht, without which life would have been inconceivably poorer. Because she went to Ashes School as well there, didn't she?
She did, yeah. And you see, she did say that it enriched her whole outlook, not just with the language, but that broadened her outlook and everything, that her life would have been a lot less without that experience. And she loved it. She really did love it. But I think... There's so much that we could say about her, and as always, I think we're always saying, Joe, we can only, you know, do little snippets.
Yeah.
But she had written, now a lot of her poems are in Irish, but I'll read some of them in Irish, but I can give you the translations as well, because look, you know, not everyone listening might be, you know, fluent Irish speakers.
Leifa.
There's a poem called Jack. And I know that's coming from her time in that area, you know, back in Dunquin. And I could read both versions of it, the Irish and the English, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Jack. Strapra fionse trehe erarda, mokdra miora o iher tira, niki noig fasta go rausta iha, ero lar sumint ige e grinka. Akni darutad a gege in a himpel, agar a kuhn na a kain chivilta, in a lane of on is a grug nur kirra, bui fin lamper biogan ila, fogiga a her tolibin eegiga, posig banagas tokig steeploch, och marconic to stumps a reach ni kiefer, baby on their cock, ob gel lum cree, borda rare gorever creeha, rot is shanes and art ne mainche, monitor trake a good day creaker, the bain sour shimmer raw 40 a. Now, that poem is translated into English by Eleni Chilinon, and I can read it, the English version of it. And again, Jack. A fine, fair-headed, six-foot fellow, a farmer's son from the country westward. On hard cement we danced together, a night in the future he'll not remember. But I won't forget how his arms embraced me, his quiet smile, civil conversation. In his clean white shirt, his neat combed hair, yellow in the lamplight as the oil ran lower. He'll get the land his father leaves him, marry and raise a house full of children. But no one will see the man I danced with. What did I care who saw my fancy? All that is best in the world I wish him. Blessings on every place that holds him. Every promise fulfilled in living. My chosen partner for all this summer.
Whoa.
So that was a kind of a memory, and I think she did it. You know, sometimes people say that I suppose there'll always be critics and they have their place, but they say that her poetry, not everyone was saying this now, but it would have been, she adhered more to kind of the rhythm and the structure and the Irish rather than the content, and I don't agree. And loads of people, like, you know, they don't agree with it and say that, you know, she wrote what she felt and what she wanted to capture in poetry. And I think she has a poem, another poem that I might read straight away because it shows like that. I'll read this one in English, Joe, and it's called Moment of Truth. Is there any sense in being alive, Mara? My little sister asked me. No longer a little sister, but a fine woman in her prime, widow and mother, past the flush of youth, but still my little sister. Our mother, the most loving and accomplished woman who ever lived, had the same question. And still, and that Gaeltacht woman who taught me, a woman is not a seal. Is there a God, Mara? She'd say. Upon my oath, I don't know. But I need the neighbour's faith as a map to leave a mark on, and that mark a boundary stone. Am I losing my mind, Mara? If she is, she's not the only one. So there's a nice twist, you know, she gives to things. And she was the type of person that I think, and I've already said, I think that she was formidable, but she wouldn't ever shy away from controversy. That was not her style. You know, she was strong. She faced things rather than turn away from them. And she was a very interesting and witty kind of a woman. That's the images I have of her anyway, Joe. Mm. But... she was like, I think her Kerry connection was something very, very strong. And again, she became like one of the few, you know, authorities in the Munster dialect. That was one of her things. And she had loads of acclaims and everything else. But for instance, in later life, she was elected to Eas Dána. And this is now skipping yeah. forward a bit, but she was elected to Eas Dána, and which is a great honour and everything. And a year later, Francis Stewart, he was elected. He had made some very kind of statements that would have been seen as, you know, sympathising with the Nazis. And because of that, Mara resigned and left. Because, you know, she was an active kind of, you know, what she felt she made known. And she wasn't afraid to, you know, she was afraid of anything, really. But
yeah, he was alleged to have made anti-Semitic viewpoints and things. Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. That was her way of, you know, she was an active object and that was it. You know, she wouldn't tolerate and she wouldn't be in Eas Dána then. But so she was very strong. Like, a lot of people mightn't have had the strength and the courage, but
and was she strict with the Irish language as well? I read somewhere. Was she, you know, she was very particular.
I think she would have got kind of what we would call, you know, the pure. Now, not everyone might agree with me there, but that purity of language, you know, she got it straight from, I suppose, the horse's mouth, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
Because she was immersed in it and went to school there. So I think she got it, you know, it soaked into her. So I think she retained that standard in herself, you know, forevermore throughout her life. And of course, she went on. I mean, her life, it wasn't controversial in the sense, but she was always pushing forward, making inroads and that, and she was very well educated, highly educated. She had a degree in Irish, French and literature from UCD. And then during World War II, Mara studied law. And I think she has the reputation of being, if not the first, one of the first women in Ireland to be called to the bar, which was a huge accomplishment if you think at the times as well that were in it. And after that, she had served as a diplomat in, you know, like secretary to the ambassador in places like Spain and France and places. But there was something remarkable that she did say, that when she was in Spain, and this was during Franco's regime, she said she found she was aware of how undermined and undervalued women were. And what I think is remarkable that she was asked then, did she notice or experience that in Ireland? And she said no. And I find that now, probably because of her background and probably because of, you know, maybe an influential kind of a background and of the person herself, but she wouldn't have experienced it probably the way an awful lot of women would have experienced that. But I just noted that the two contrasts, that she could see it in Spain and yet she couldn't see it in Ireland where it did exist. But I think that was, again, to do with her life and her, you know, her background and so on.
Very good. Well, we'll pause there, Bernadette, because we have to go to a break, and we'll come back and we'll be talking more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Also, we're speaking of poetry with Bernadette Ní Riada, and our poet of note, I'm a poet myself and I didn't even know it, is Mara Vacathy, of course, with deep West Kerry connections, went to National School and stayed with her uncle there for a time, was born in Dublin, very highly educated woman, well travelled, and like her book reads like a novel of the places she was living in and visited, Bernadette, doesn't it? And then an accomplished writer, poet and everything else.
Definitely. No, she lived what they say, I don't know what this expression sometimes means, but a very full life and a very, you know, she really did. But I think that there was, she was always a very well-known character, I think, apart from her poetry and that, which is kind of what she's always remembered for. But of course, I think it was in 1962 that Mara married Conor Cruise O'Brien, and that didn't go down well with her family. And there was other people that had upset, because he had been married, I think, in a civil ceremony, and then he was separated, and they got married in the Catholic Church and everything, but it just wasn't something that was liked by several different sides, and I won't, you know, go further than that. But they were both involved, like he was in the United Nations, and they were in New York. Like, she, another thing, like, that she wasn't afraid to object physically and visibly to the war in Vietnam, and both she and Conor Cruise were arrested in New York because they were protesting and all the rest of it. So I think she did go out and she didn't just, you know, she put her money where her mouth was, you know, that kind of a person. But I think throughout her life, I get the sense that her relationship with her father was fraught in that sense. You know, it was never a cosy, kind of easy. And I suppose if you think of his republicanism and then his developing his political career. So I think Maura's mother was the one that held the anchor. And, you know, she was influenced a lot by the mother. And I think she's more like her mother than her father. That's my opinion now. But there's a poem that she wrote, and it's, I think I could read it in both English and Irish, but I think I'll just read the English version, Joe, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. It's called Trouble Spot, General Post Office, 1986, and this gives you know, it gives that flavour of the relationship she had with her father. So here, father, is this where it started? Here we became strangers to each other. Was it here? You thought most of what we said was nonsense, even when we agreed with you. Inheritors of the event, who never knew the smell of gunpowder or of terror, who never fired a shot in anger, worse yet, never stood up to one. We retreated from you into the Pale of Irish. That was our familiar Terry Gurr, and the Ulsterman in you could not follow our tracks or tame our barbarism. Spencer's civility had beguiled you. We took after our mother's tribe, the high-blown ways of Munster. You were the recalcitrant old badger, run to ground by howling spaniels. In later years we tried again. You learned to be charitable, but we still had to tread carefully. Your intelligence and sense of justice never practiced deception. I am the same age as the state, and neither turned out as you wished. In this place, father, you are the unknown youth who went missing. Neglect and awkwardness hide the key from my mind, but I hear now the northern accent of the elder man I loved with hard devotion. Do you remember the rebuke you delivered before it became fashionable? You spoke thus, I see no cause for rejoicing that Irishmen once again are killing other Irishmen on the streets of Belfast. And that was translated by Louis de Prayer.
Yeah, but you can see the tension between them there, can't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I would say even before she married Conor Cruise or anything like that, there was, because she had notions about being an actress. And I think she had applied to the Abbey Theatre, and I think the father became aware of it, and he notified them that there is no way his daughter was going on the stage. So, you know, that there was, you could nearly get that sense of tension throughout. Mm-hmm. But as well as everything else, I suppose I'm given an impression of a very serious kind of a scholarly woman, but she was witty. She was a very witty woman as well, I think. And she would entertain people with stories, and there's one very good one. When Maura was a child, and I mean a baby, like, you know, she was in she had an uncle in Wicklow, and she was in the house there. And let's just say a great, very well-known man as well, De Valera. Let's just say, because the times they were in it, he was moving rapidly from place to place on the run. And he was given refuge in the house for a few nights. But anyway, I suppose they were trying to get the room ready for him, and they were going taking out the baby. And he said, "All you've heard there, sure I have five of my own." So that was that. And then Maura, as an adult, often entertained friends and all her friends, when she had this lovely story, and she used to say, "Well, you know, I did sleep with De Valera." So I think that was shown, like, she could see that, you know, she was a witty person. But speaking of De Valera, there is a poem, and I think it's worth reading. Yeah. I might read it in both versions.
Very good.
And maybe De Valera, because, yeah, you know, I won't go into it, but he had a certain vision and image of the women of Ireland, maidens barefoot dancing at the crossroads, mm-hmm. and so on. I'll say no more about that. So it's called Cré na mná tí. Cúni bhan tála gal agus an clown face mocht. Ní agus skúr agus lán. Cúrig prín agus lót. Umpig tóta, lag brót. Ach, nos juhurazid, ni mordish an filiacht kuma, the housewife's credo. Keep the house tidy, the family in order. Wash, scrub, clean. Get food and drink. Turn bedding, shake the mat. And like Scheherazade, add poetry to that. I think she captured that very well, and I think it tied in with the story that we were talking about De Valera. So
yeah, I think it's wonderful. It shows her wit as well, like you said. And it shows that she was a formidable woman as well. She's lots of different things. I was just reading about her: translator, critic, scholar. She was so many more things. But like you said, it's only a snapshot we give here this morning. But again, it's wonderful to profile these poets, and it just shows, Bernadette, the caliber of poets we have in this country as well.
Definitely, without a doubt.
Maura Vakanti, another one to add to the list.
Another one to add. No, she was a fantastic. I mean, her name, everyone, I'd say, you know, will know a little bit about Maura Vakanti. And again, she did for the Irish language, you know, but there was more to her than like just reporting. I know she wrote essays and that, but she was, you know, she travelled so much, she lived so many places. And as I say, I'm coming back to it again, but she did live that full life. She lived. And Joe, 99, so the poetry didn't do her any harm.
not at all. And I know, Bernadette, you said at your launch that you're a proud Kerry woman. And you can see as well that the Kerry influence had a big influence on this woman as well. So we claim that as well. We claim her as well. So
that's the great thing.
Bernadette, thanks a million. And it was a great pleasure meeting you and having the crack with you at your launch. And thanks a million for coming on this morning. I look forward to seeing who you're going to bring next month.
Thank you to Joe Sloan.
That's all we have time for this morning. My thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. Francis is on the way, so keep it here on Radio Kerry. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks' time. It's Frank Lewis next Saturday morning, so stay tuned for that. But until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.